House Committee on Judiciary coming to order. Today's April 11th, 2013. House Bill 3327, which is the first one on the agenda, is going to be rolled over to Monday. And House Bill 2431 is being held over, rolled over as well.
So we're not going to move them?
We are not going to move those two.
To Ways and Means?
No. That's $20 million, so we're probably not going to move it anywhere. Opening work session on House Bill 2115. Mr. Schmidt?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2115 is the intoxicants definition bill. There's a dash 11 to this bill. What's changed between the dash 11 and the dash 10s was the dash 10 had a two-year sunset. The dash 11 has a four-year sunset to allow more time to study what the impact of this is. The dash 11 bill would change the definition of intoxicants to add five substances, which is section 2, sub 4, A, B, C, D, and E, amitriptyline, cyclobenzaprine, diphenhydramine, dextromethorphan, and tramadol.
Okay. And we'll, this does have a fiscal, although it is required, we're going to go ahead and move it directly to Ways and Means. Are we planning to if we pass it?
So you did the dash 11?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 11 amendment into House Bill 2115.
Representative Garrett moves the dash 11 amendments into 2115, and thank you for not saying those words again.
Oh, you're welcome.
Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2115 be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Garrett moves that House Bill 2115 as amended be sent to Ways and Means. We could have one.
Mr. Chair, I amend my motion. I move that House Bill 2115 be moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative.
Technically, isn't it moved to the floor, a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
It doesn't have a subsequent referral.
It doesn't have a subsequent
referral. I withdraw.
Is there any, there's a motion to move it with a due pass to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Next item is a work session on House
Close
Bill.
Close the work session.
That was a work session.
We need to close the work session.
We'll close that work session and open a work session on House Bill 2601. Mr. Schmidt.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2601 allows the use of red light photo camera pictures in judicial proceedings other than failure to obey traffic control device prosecutions. There is a dash 3 amendment to this bill, which would limit the use to criminal judicial proceedings and only the criminal violation of failure to obey a traffic control device, so not other violations like not wearing a seatbelt or a cell phone, only failure to obey a traffic control device.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment into House Bill 2601.
Representative Garrett moves the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2601. Is there any discussion? Representative Barton.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to state something for the record. I'm happy to go along with this amendment and the bill as amended. I do note that we're making a policy choice. It's not that big of a deal, particularly that this kind of evidence will be admissible in a criminal context but not a civil context. I think that there's no principled reason for that. I think it's kind of silly, actually. I think the dash ones would probably be a better approach, but I recognize we don't have the paperwork. I think that policy, rather than coming from a well-reasoned distinction about why evidence should be admissible in one context but not another, is instead a result of just the people who are on the work group. No offense to them, I appreciate their getting involved. The ACLU on one end, which wanted to, I guess, restrict use of this data, and law enforcement on the other, which frankly doesn't particularly care about admissibility in the civil context, and that's why we have the dash threes. It's making sausage, it's no big deal, but I thought that should be noted. Someday, in the unlikely event it ever becomes relevant, they're going to wonder why that loophole happened, and that's why.
Is there any further discussion? The dash threes are in.
Mr. Chair, I move, are we moving that today?
Yeah.
I move House Bill 2601 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves House Bill 2601 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Open the, close that work session. Open work session on House Bill 2962. Representative Olson will carry 2601. Thank you, Representative.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2962 changes the current standard applied by courts in speedy trial law. Defendant will bear the burden of proof in showing that the delay in trial caused excessive pretrial incarceration, impairment to the defense, or humiliation and indignity suffered by the defendant as a result of the delay. It declares an emergency. It's effective upon passage. There is a dash one amendment to this bill. Which essentially would repeal the statutory speedy law as it is right now.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash ones into House Bill 2962.
Representative Krieger moves dash one amendments into House Bill 2962. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2962 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2962 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Garrett.
Just a comment for the record. I will not oppose this bill, and I won't repeat everything I said when we had the hearing. There is a lot beneath the surface of this bill is a really troubling issue about the resources we're committing to the courts. And this bill is a removal of a procedural protection that I think we're only considering doing because we have a resource problem. And that makes me extremely uncomfortable. It's not enough to oppose the legislation. I understand the policy rationale for the bill, but I don't feel good about it, and I wish we weren't in this position.
Thank you very much for those comments. Those are right on point. Yeah. Representative.
I would like to echo my colleague's comments, but for me it's enough for a no vote. Looking at the resources from the perspective of ways and means, I think we need to deal with it.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Hicks?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Excuse.
Representative Williamson?
No.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hicks will be the carrier. Okay, close that and open a public hearing on.
Just one more on that back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
3277.
Thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 3277.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3277 amends ORS 137-106 to make clear that the prosecuting attorney must present restitution information to the court within 90 days of the time that that judgment is entered. There are dash ones, dash twos, and dash threes. Significantly, I believe the two amendments that are really before the committee is the dash two, which would require that a district attorney notify the defense attorney 10 days prior to the presentation of the restitution information of who the witnesses will be and what information they intend to present. The remedy for failing to do so would be that the defense attorney could get a set over. The dash three amendment makes it clear, it fixes a little bit of the language in the bill and makes it clear that this applies to prosecutions or that applies to sentencings that are occurring once this bill is passed, not
personal. Okay, thank you. Is there any question? Okay, twos and threes.
You have both, don't you?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash twos into House Bill amendments in House Bill 3277.
Representative Krieger moves the dash two amendments in House Bill 3277. Discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move the dash threes into House Bill 3277.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 3277. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3277 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3277 to the floor with a due pass as amended. Is there any questions? Is there any objections? Seeing none, bill passes. Representative Hicks will carry that bill. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2204.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2204 adds oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone in unspecified quantities to the delivery and manufacture statute at a crime series of level 6 or 8, depending on the quantity, as well as to the commercial drug offense rules. It adds oxycodone to definition of controlled substances, adds oxycodone to mandatory sentence where a person dies or suffers serious physical injury from ingestion after delivery, declares an emergency effective upon passage, and there is an amendment to this bill, and I believe the witnesses are able to testify to that.
Okay, thank you. Steve Migrand and Rob Bovet.
Good afternoon. Again, Steve Migrant from the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office, here with Rob Bovet from the Lincoln County District Attorney's Office, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Krieger and Garrett, committee members, thank you again for your time. I was before you last month on House Bill 2204, in which we asked you to consider providing an overdose enhancement for state prosecutors. We think that's going to be an invaluable resource. We typically enhance drug trafficking offenses for quantities, but we have no current enhancement in the state system for somebody who delivers heroin or oxycodone that results in another person's death. As I'm sure you're aware, the federal prosecutors have a lem bias law at their disposal, in which a 20-year mandatory minimum is available. That isn't always the best option for lower-level dealers, frankly. And so for some of these people that are certainly culpable, that are responsible for distributing these drugs that killed 143 people in Oregon in 2011, we are looking for an intermediary solution. And that solution is to have an overdose enhancement in Oregon, making it a level 9 if somebody distributes heroin or oxycodone that results in a serious physical injury, or making it a level 10 offense if, in fact, that heroin or oxycodone that's delivered results in death. That was really the impetus behind this bill, was that overdose enhancement. Recognizing that there could be some potential fiscal impact from that, we tried to be creative and tried to come up with a solution that would come up with either a neutral or even a negative fiscal impact. So we recalibrated the marijuana guidelines that are currently trigger prison sentences. And those have been dramatically changed in this proposal under 2204. And we are really trying to offset any potential fiscal impact by this overdose enhancement by reducing the number of people that we're sending to prison for marijuana-related offenses. As I'm sure many of you are aware, in HB 3194 and HB 3195, these concepts have been used. In 3194, the marijuana recalibration was taken from this concept and implemented into 3194. In 3195, the overdose enhancement is part of that bill, as well as the marijuana recalibration. It's under the current state of affairs, it's unclear as to what the future is of either of those two bills, and we are asking you as a committee to move this bill forward. We think that it provides a well-balanced approach to these types of prosecutions. It reallocates some resources, and it gives us a good opportunity, certainly as prosecutors, to focus on priority targets. And we've had tremendous success prosecuting drug trafficking organizations using an overdose enhancement. And having that intermediary solution in the state system would be tremendously beneficial to state prosecutors. The final component of this bill is providing an enhancement, a substantial quantity enhancement, for opiate prescription pills. We've seen tremendous abuse from these. Mr. Bobet's going to speak to those. And the amendments that are before you today really focus on those substantial quantities. Just to close, I think, on my behalf, I think that right now, if you deliver 4,500 pills of oxycodone in Oregon, that's a level 4 offense with a maximum of 60 days in jail. Period, end of story. If you deliver one, it's a level 4 offense with 60 days in jail. There's no proportionality, and I think that we need to create that. I'd like to ask Mr. Bobet to share his thoughts.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Bovet, Lincoln County District Attorney. This bill is actually modeled on a bill I crafted in 2011, which we decided to back off of and not pursue for a variety of reasons. The time wasn't right. I think the time is right now. I would characterize this bill as being smart on drug crime. We have to be always cognizant of not only the different levels of community impact from various drugs, because all drugs are not equal, but we also have to look at trends. And what I provided for you in lieu of any written testimony is just the latest drug trends in Oregon in terms of drug abuse. These are drug treatment admission data. It's the best data set that I ever use because it's a very large number and it doesn't show spikes, and it basically you can equalize for treatment capacity by converting to percentages. So what this basically is showing you is that we've done a real good job with meth over the past 6 years, as I previously mentioned before this committee. But for the first time, and as long as we've been charting this data, we can now say that opiate abuse is the number one drug abuse problem in the state of Oregon. And I say that because if you had that 11% number of prescription drug abuse and that 23% from heroin, you get 34%. And it's clearly the highest number. And it's the one that's continuing to go up. And so, as was previously testified to, we really need to be smarter about who we're sending to jail on 1145 and who we're sending to prison in terms of community impact. And it only makes sense that we make adjustments on a going forward basis. I echo the sentiments that whether 3194 passes or not, or whether 3195 passes, those are the bigger policy packages, or even Senate Bill 40, which has been considered on the Senate side to make some adjustments to marijuana offenses, which may or may not be seen in this committee. I think this bill needs to move because it's basically, as I say, smart on drug crime and keeps us ahead of the curve. We don't need to be sending folks to prison that don't need to be there, and vice versa. As you heard, kind of a graphic example, we're letting some major drug dealers not be held accountable to any significant degree because we've not adjusted for the trends and the time. So happy to answer any questions if you might have any. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment to this bill that these gentlemen are speaking about is not finished yet. It's in the draft. I'm handing out the draft's being handed out to you right now, so we wouldn't be able to move on this today. But essentially, we've got the public testimony portion of it out. We carry it over for a work session to give time to consider the amendment.
I have one more comment, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
My testimony, of course, reflected the amendments because the bill is kind of a shell. It needs to be filled in, and so the amendments would fill it in. But the second thing is that I project, and of course this is for the bean counters to make sure of, I project this is actually a net savings. I think you're going to get a negative fiscal on this bill because overall we're going to be sending less people to prison and less people to jail under 1145 on balance. So I think this is a good idea both as a fiscal matter and as a drug policy matter.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2204.
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2362.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2362 allows a person whom a stalking order has been issued against to request a hearing for the court to set aside the stalking order 3 years after it has lapsed or within 1 year from the time it was terminated by the court.
Okay, I don't have anybody signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anybody?
Here we go.
Okay. Wendy Oren and Lindsay Soto. They're coming. Okay.
From over forward.
Yeah. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, we'll stand at ease for a few minutes until the witnesses arrive. Would
We're
Good afternoon. Oh, thank you.
Identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Lindsay Soto. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem.
I'm Gwendolyn Oren. I'm in Kim Thatcher's district, a citizen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about House Bill 2362. What we're trying to do with this bill is to try and create some parity in our laws regarding setting aside and sealing of certain court cases. So right now, as you know, there is a procedure by which you can set aside and seal a conviction under certain sets of circumstances. The main circumstances you have to meet are there has to be a waiting period depending on whether it's an arrest or conviction of 1 to 3 years. You have to have been compliant with your probation and completed all your probationary terms, and you also have to have a lack of other convictions or arrests in certain circumstances. So as it stands right now, you could be convicted of the crime of stalking and in court having had a trial or pled guilty to that crime or being proven beyond a reasonable doubt after a trial, and then after 3 years, if you met all the other conditions, you would be able to set that conviction aside and have it sealed. Unfortunately, there's also a process for civil stalking and protective orders that would not allow you to be able to have your stalking citation or temporary protective stalking order set aside and sealed. So what you have is a disparity between people who are actually convicted of crimes and the burden of proof is met. It's actually a much higher burden of proof in a criminal case, but you have also a stalking case where all the petitioner has to establish is by a preponderance of the evidence that you've met this level of threat to the respondent, and you can never get that set aside or sealed.
Even
if it's dismissed. So that's what we're looking for here, is this law specifically, this bill specifically talks about if you show up for the hearing and if the order is not continued or if it's dismissed, then after a year waiting period, you would petition the court for the ability to set aside and have this sealed, basically. And it also provides that the person who sought the order would be notified and have the opportunity to make a statement as well. You can't have violated the temporary protective stalking order while it was in place. So those are some protections that we thought were important to make sure were in the bill to protect people from a situation where there were some negative things that were done by the respondent that the respondent could potentially benefit from this. So it's really designed for cases where the court felt that there wasn't enough evidence, or if the person who sought the order doesn't show up for court and it's dismissed, we're looking to have a procedure that's similar to that of a criminal conviction or arrest to have that situation set aside or sealed. Let me give you an example. In addition to the stalking, someone can actually commit the crime of assault against a person and have that crime later expunged. So if a defendant was to punch someone in the face and be convicted of assault for that person could later, as long as he or she complied with all of the conditions of ORS 137.225, the criminal set-aside statute, could get that set aside and sealed. Someone who threatened to punch someone in the face and was
had a stalking citation that was continued after a hearing would not have the right to later have that actually set aside. So we believe that it brings some parity to the laws surrounding civil stalking, and we believe that it's a really appropriate bill, and we'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't have the paperwork on this one today, so we will have to carry this over.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Okay,
thank you
very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2362. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2408.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2408 adds to the crime endangering welfare of a minor persons who permit minors to enter or remain in places where cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine activity occurs or is maintained, declares emergency effective upon passage. There is an amendment to this bill, and we do have the paperwork for both the amendment and the original version, and I believe the witness will talk to the amendment.
Okay, Steve, microphone again, please.
Thanks again. Good afternoon, everybody. Again, Steve Migrant, Clackamas County District Attorney's Office. I was, again, before you on this bill as well back in March, and OCDLA noted that there may be that the statute was, or the proposal was overbroad. We refer to this statute as, you know, the drug-affected children statute. That's really what it's designed to, the group that it's designed to impact. And so as a consequence, we went back, we met with OCDLA, we attempted to refine and adopt some of their suggestions. We in fact did adopt several of their suggestions to amend the language that this would impact a person who has a permits a children or a child under the age of 18 years to be exposed to these unlawful controlled substances, and that these substances were later detected in that child's blood, urine, or hair. We're typically seeing hair follicle tests being done, at least in Clackamas County, where these children are being pulled out of drug homes and are testing positive for heroin and methamphetamine, and on a less of a basis with cocaine. So we've really tried to attempt to narrow this down so that it does fit this group of children that we're trying to protect. We've also noted that it is a crime category 6. We've paralleled that with the child in neglect 1 statute, which is also would be a parallel statute in many respects, and that is a category 6 as defined by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. So we're just trying to differentiate a child who's in a home who's exposed to controlled substances or where controlled substances may be located. That remains a misdemeanor endangering the welfare of a minor if the drugs are there and the child's there. But once the child is actually exposed to these substances and ingests these controlled substances, either through touching, swallowing, or inhaling these substances from the smoke, then that would elevate this to a Class C misdemeanor, or excuse me, a Class C felony, and would be, again, a crime seriousness 6 on the sentencing guidelines. Thank you. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions regarding this bill? Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sponsored the bill. I obviously support it. Question of fact, if you know, in terms of hair follicle testing, the sensitivity to it, how much exposure are we talking for it for example, Clackamas County be able to measure it in hair follicle testing?
That's a Representative Barton, that is a very good question. I know that there.
Sorry, I didn't get it to you in advance.
No problem at all. There are certain thresholds that, based on my experience as a prosecutor, there are certain thresholds that have to be met in terms of them detecting, the crime lab detecting that particular substance. So it would. I do not have the exact number what a hair follicle threshold would be, but it would require some level of toxicity within the child.
If I may, please, but no. Just even though we don't have the specifics, is it your understanding, because it is mine, that it's not purely incidental contact, it's actually some kind of meaningful exposure for it to be measured in hair follicle tests.
That's,
is that right?
That's my belief. Okay. And typically, these children, there are other circumstances that are attendant that lead law enforcement to these homes. It's the child really doesn't get the hair plucked until the child is removed from the home, typically by DHS, because of concerning circumstances about the living situation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a fiscal on this. There's a fiscal on the bill without the amendment, and there's a fiscal with the dash one. The fiscal without amendment is roughly, you should have in front of you, $202,000 per biennium. With the amendment, that goes down to $40,000 per biennium. So we have everything we need to move the dash one, but it should probably be with a request for Ways and Means.
Any discussion? Okay. Where are you reading these emails?
I know.
Just for the audience's information, you see the iPads and laptops up here. We're able now to hook into the system, so that's why what people are doing. They're not playing solitaire. Thank you.
And yeah, actually, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I read the form wrong. Without the dash one, the fiscal would be over $1.5 million. And per biennium, that's significantly different. With the dash one, it would be over $300,000. So we'd still need to request referral to Ways and Means.
High. My gut tells me that seems high.
You would know.
Close public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2408.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendments in House Bill 2408.
Representative Krieger moves the dash one amendments in 2408. Any discussion, any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2408 as amended to the floor with a due pass to Ways and Means.
Request referral to Ways and Means.
Request referral with a request to referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 248 as amended to the floor with the due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's ordered.
Who wants to carry?
There's no carry.
It goes to Ways and Means.
We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2549.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2549 creates a three-tier system for ranking sex offenders based on their risk, as is established by a designated risk assessment tool. It requires all offenders in the current system to be reclassified. Offenders classified in the first tier are eligible for relief from reporting obligations 5 years after the end of their supervision. Offenders classified in second tier are eligible to apply for relief 10 years after the end of their supervision. Offenders classified in the third tier are eligible to apply to be moved into Tier 2 10 years after their supervision has ended. Tier 3 offenders are not eligible to apply for total relief from reporting obligations ever. Requires PSRB to administer all classification assessments. Lays out requirements for notification of public. Requires all classifications of existing registrants to be completed by December 1st, 2016. Declares an emergency. Is effective upon passage. And members of the committee, Mr. Chair, you should be aware that there's been a work group that's been working on this. There are three amendments, and I believe there are people here to testify on each of the three amendments. But what those three amendments essentially do, the first amendment is what the work group came up as some consensus changes to the bill that everyone agreed on. The dash two amendment would be one faction of the group, the ODAA version of request for amendments, and then the dash three would be the OCDLA request for amendments.
And could you just describe the basic difference between the two?
Sure. The basic difference, the dash two amendments would list five crimes that you would never be able to get relief from registration from. And those would be your highest level sex crimes, rape one, sodomy one, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, also kidnapping with any of those crimes or burglary with those crimes. So you would not be able to get relief from that. Also, it would change the 5-year registration to 10 years. There might be a few other smaller changes, but there are witnesses to talk on that. The Dash 3 amendment, the OCDLA version, would allow for people to request relief from registration at the end of their term. So say you had to do register for 10 years. At the end of your term, you could go into, I believe, a sheriff's office or an equivalent, maybe state police, and say, I've done my 10 years of registration, and if they run you in LEDs and you've met the requirements, without a hearing, you could be relieved from registration. And there's also, there might be some other tweaks to that, but I know Gail Meyer from OCDLA is here to talk on that.
Okay, why don't we have Gail Meyer and Jeff Wood, please.
Yours. Really? Okay.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Again, I want to hats off to everyone who worked so hard on this work group. This work group's been meeting for about 18 months, and there was a lot of expertise there around the table. And for the longest time, it was a very large work group with the Oregon State Police there. There were police officers. There were community correction directors, probation, parole, SOSIN, DAs, courts, everybody. We learned a lot. And what was really apparent to me was that downstream of sentencing, pretty much everyone saw this the same way. People who were who had custodial authority over sex offenders or were supervising them in the community, and law enforcement who was encountering them in the community, all saw this the same way. They pretty much all said, this has got to be tiered. Would you please tell us the level of risk of this person when we encounter them? And the other predominant theme was, it's okay if we start leaning and screening our registry so that it's not just so bloated and so full. There really was consensus, the lower risk people don't need to register forever. The good news was the community corrections directors already had a think tank, best practice committee, already come up with a posture to present to everyone, and so we tweaked it. We looked at other states. The bill and the Dash 1 amendment is the product, really, of their expertise and their thoughts. This is what they came up with as the evidence-based practice and what's doable here in Oregon. OCDLA supports the base bill and supports the Dash 1 amendments. I'd like to tell you that it would be, in my view, very easy for you to take the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s and just put them aside. Because we introduced our Dash 3s really, quite frankly, seriously, as an antidote to the Dash 2s. And if you don't adapt the Dash 2s, then you don't need to consider the Dash 3s. We really do think that, you know, the lawyers in the trenches at sentencing are not the experts on supervising sex offenders. These guys are. And the bill and the Dash 1s represents their best work. So we support that. I will say that with respect to the OCDL amendments in the Dash 3, it doesn't quite read exactly as I had wanted, so I can't really proffer it up to the committee as capturing my thoughts. It has perhaps different standards and time frames in there. And it's difficult to testify in anticipation of what hasn't yet been said, but if I would perhaps bring to the attention of the committee some of the aspects of the district attorney's proposal, which is the Dash 2. On the first page of the Dash 2, the District Attorney's Association's suggestion is that for certain kinds of crimes independent of risk, the person is never eligible for relief from registration. Distinguish, if you will, please, clearly between always having that conviction on your record from always having to register. This bill only deals with the obligation to register. We're not talking here at any time about expungement. No, no, no. Nothing to do with expungement. This only deals with the obligation to register. So,
thank you.
The bill, the dash one, tethers the obligation to register to the level of risk. If you are a low, low risk person, you qualify to get off, at least apply to get off with a hearing after so much time. Same with a tier two, never with a tier three. The district attorney's proposal is to say, independent of your level of risk, there are certain crimes for which you would never qualify to get off. And all I would want to suggest to the committee is, again, not all of these crimes always look the same way. So a rape in the first degree can be very violent, forcible compulsion, the whole shot. That sounds like a high-risk person. It can also be incest. It can also be incest, and I defer to Mr. Woods, but I believe he'll tell you that a certain profile of incest offender is a very low-risk person. Sodomy in the first degree can be very violent. It can also be mutual oral sex amongst people with a delayed report, and so the victim's less than 12, could be a sibling, could be not, delayed report, offender now apprehended and now convicted of a sodomy one. These don't always look the same. And so our problem with saying by category of crime, it controls everything, is averse to really what the work group put together, which is let the registry be determined by the level of risk posed by that offender. It works both ways. You can have a very low-lying offense and be a very high-risk offender, and you'll be on the internet. So it works both ways. That's number one. Number two, the other thing the district attorneys are proposing is that the board shall deny a petition for relief from registry if you've had more than one sex crime, been convicted of more than one conviction, or unless the convictions were from the same transaction or occurrence or resulted from the same single judicial proceeding. Again, all I want to say is, again, that's not tethered to risk. So in one of the work groups, turns out one of the police officers there was supervising one of the individuals that I had previously defended. He was 20. He had consensual sex with a 15-year-old. He was convicted of rape, too. It was ongoing a relationship, convictions occurring in two counties. So he is convicted of more than one crime, not occurring in a single judicial episode. Two different convictions, two different counties. That officer said to me, he is the most low-level risk person I know on this registry. He should get off. So according to the district attorney's proposal, he would not be allowed. According to the proposal put out by the experts, it's, again, tethered to risk. So OCDLA submits, your bill is a wonderful bill. The dash one amendments are great amendments. It makes it better. And we would ask the committee to approve the bill with the dash ones.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I serve as the Parole and Probation Division Commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. As Gail graciously alluded to, I'm also representing the Sex Offender Supervision Network, the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As a body that's responsible, at least locally in Marion County, for the supervision of over 550 registered sex offenders. Over the years, we've gathered quite a bit of knowledge in terms of effective practices, what works. There's been a lot of research on the subject of supervision of sex offenders, management of sex offenders, and one thing that does appear very clear is if you base things on crime alone, while you certainly have a system in terms of best public policy, it is most effective to base these criteria on risk, risk to recidivate, risk to commit a new sexual offense, and hence the genesis of House Bill 2549. We're very supportive of the Dash 1 amendments that specify
the role of the PSRB, Psychiatric Security Review Board, some clarity of the timelines, and then specifying the criteria for relief from registration if it is warranted, if the person is a low risk to recidivate. Scale alluded to, I think the only concern that we have with the Dash 2 amendments is, again, although they do list some very serious crimes, there can be a possibility of low-risk offenders who still would be there for life. Part of the original intent of this group was to go over what our current practices are. And again, as I stated previously, crime-based classification in and of itself do not, provide for very sound public policy. If we integrate risk within this, that is where you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck. And although I certainly agree with the intent of we do want the most serious offenders to remain on the registry, for the most serious offenders to be placed on the internet, as Gail alluded to, but I think it is captured in the Dash 1 amendments when you do look at page 3, I believe, in terms of some of the criteria that the parole board would be looking at in determining what relief or whether somebody is warranting relief. And they will be looking at the nature and age of the degree of the violence, the nature of the crime, the age of the victim of the offense, and other criteria, including the performance while they're on supervision. Did they complete an approved sex offender treatment program? And what is their stability employment? And do they have appropriate social support systems? And one thing that we have seen over the year is some of those criteria that I have met are statistically validated, have been shown empirically to decrease the risk for recidivism, and really do provide that best public policy for this very at-risk population. With that, I am available for questions, and thank you for your time.
Questions?
Let me ask you guys kind of a fourth choice question. You have Sophie's choice. I recognize you prefer the bill as amended as Dash with the Dash 1 amendments. Let's pretend this committee adopted the Dash 2 amendments. It's fourth choice. Would you rather we pass the bill as amended with the Dash 2s, because although you don't, that's not your optimal version, you think it still improves public policy, or would you then prefer to kill the bill?
Do you want me to answer first?
You can go first. I'll talk about my bill.
Forgive me. Representative Barton, Chair Barker, members of the committee. A very pointed question. In terms of would I prefer to kill the bill altogether and as opposed to supporting Dash 2, my personal answer is no, I would not. I think, as I've said in previous testimony before the committee, the current laws and statutes pertaining to registration and notification, I realize, people like to think of them as two separate issues, but I would argue that with the passage of Megan's Law and the Jacob Wetterling Act, they are intertwined, and they are almost very similar and go together. The current laws that we have right now really is, as I've said before, is disproportionate, can be, or at least historically, in terms of predatory offenders, some statutory offenders within that population, and really a one-size-fits-all approach. I do not think that is good public policy, and I think it's been very confusing to the state as a whole. And so in terms of the Dash 2 amendments, I would much rather have a Dash 2 amendment than have current law in existence as is.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, there are elements of the Dash 1 that are not in the Dash 2 that I think, quite frankly, are simply good policy. And so I would not ask you to consider them either ors. The Dash 1s are the results of a consensus of everybody at the table. And there were certain elements of it that the district attorneys wanted to exempt themselves from. And so which they wanted to exempt themselves from ended up in the Dash 2s. But that doesn't mean that they disagree with everything in the Dash 1s. So the parts of the Dash 1s that need to be preserved. I would submit that the things from our vantage point, that's most distressing about the Dash 2s, that it turns the whole work group on its head. We sat there talking for 18 months about the legitimacy and the validity of operating on a risk-based system. And the premise of the Dash 2 amendments is, well, but only sometimes, not always. And that underscores and undergirds the entire purpose behind the bill, really. I mean, even officers were saying, tell me who I'm looking at when I stop this guy. Is he a one or a two or a three? They want to know that. And the more you start interjecting that conviction trumps risk, I think you're dismembering the foundations of the bill itself. I will tell you also, I'm really distressed about the lower part of the Dash 2 amendment, starting on line 16 to 22. This is the vagaries of how many charges are filed against you, how the parties negotiate and resolve those charges, and in single judicial proceedings that can be orchestrated by the district attorney, or it can be sometimes just the product of being two counties. Same course of conduct, same victim, but two counties, and then you'd be precluded from ever getting relief, even though the officer who's supervising the guy says, really low risk, ought to be number one category guy to go. So I don't know that I answered your question directly. I'm saying that it's pretty distressing to be part of a work group for 18 months and then at the very last minute have some people come in and say, well, we think differently, and have that prevail.
Any further questions, Representative Krieger?
I'm somewhat distressed also because when we assigned or asked the people to take part in this process of a work group, we assumed that they would have somebody at the table. And to get the people to come together that we never thought would agree, to the point that they did, the Dash 1s, and then turn around to have someone come 8 months late to the dance and expect us all to bow down, it's one of the first times I really object to the DA's position on this. They should have not done that to us. They should have not done that to the work group. And they should have not done that to the people who are dependent on a system of risk assessment. I'm going to very vehemently support the Dash points.
And in regards to what's in the Dash 2 and the enumerated crimes, to clarify, I don't see anything in any of the amendments that actually prescribes a particular level for a particular crime, and so it sounds like the officers will still know what level the individual is. That doesn't seem to be what's at issue. What's at issue within the amendments is, from my impression, is just whether certain crimes are not going to be eligible for release from registration.
That's correct.
Accurate there? Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Jim Howes and Scott Healy.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill. I testified earlier in opposition to House Bill 2549, and since then, the work group has met several times, and to echo what Mr. Wood and Ms. Meyer said, it was interesting, fascinating, and I believe productive. I come in support of the Dash 2 amendments. I don't think that would be a surprise to anyone. And I want to just talk in brief about the salient points of those amendments. First, as has been stated, it does exclude, makes never eligible, persons who have been convicted of first-degree crimes, rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and kidnapping or burglary if those crimes were committed with the intent to commit or attempt to commit any of those first three crimes. The next salient point is that, and this is the one that Ms. Meyer talked about, and I'd like to address it if I could. It says that the board shall deny a petition if a person has been convicted or found guilty except for insanity of more than one sex crime unless the convictions or findings resulted from the same act or transaction. That's language that we find in many different places in the criminal law. Second, if the convictions or findings resulted from a single court proceeding involved no victim or a single victim and were for certain lower level but registrable sexual offenses. The purpose for that, and in the work group we had a very lively discussion about whether or not a person who has been convicted of two, let's say, sex abuse in the first degree or rape in the first degree charges with different victims could be assessed under the static 99R as a level one sex offender, and under the dash one or the original bill could seek relief from registration within 5 years of being off of supervision. And the answer, although it took a little pushing and prodding from Katie Gotch, who I think we would all agree in the work group is an expert in this area, was yes. A person who has been convicted of two serious sex crimes against two different victims under the original bill could still be assessed as a level one and could seek relief from registration and be granted relief from registration very quickly, in my professional opinion. That's the reason for that. Could there be a situation where an incestuous relationship occurred in two different counties? I suppose so, but as a prosecutor, I can't say that that person doesn't pose a risk to society. That information shouldn't be known, and that's the personal and professional opinion of me as a prosecutor. The next salient point, and this is one that I brought up when I testified before, the original bill had in it a standard of, or a level of proof for the board in granting relief from registration that was simply far too low and, in my opinion, unworkable. The standard was that the board was to conclude whether or not a person was unlikely to commit another sexual offense. And we went back and we reworked it, and my memory of the most recent work group was that this was not a contentious or even really argued point. And our amendment changes that to a standard of clear and convincing evidence. What it says now is if the board determines by clear and convincing evidence that the person is statistically unlikely to reoffend, does not pose a threat to the safety of the public, and is otherwise fit for relief from registration. The last part of the Dash 2 amendments, ladies and gentlemen, deals with incorporation of victims' rights into this bill, which I think is an important, and it wasn't an oversight, but our group thought that it was important to make that explicit within the bill, the victims' rights, victims' notification. I want to say, in closing my remarks, that this bill still does very much endorse, the amendments endorse the tiering system, and it does no harm to the idea that low-risk offenders should be relieved from registration, that it is unnecessary to have low-risk offenders on the registration any longer than this body decides. It still incorporates the risk assessment. It is not a one-size-fits-all, but what it does, members of the committee, is it says certain crimes are so heinous, and I will not get into a debate about whether or not a long-term incestuous relationship between siblings or parents and children or stepchildren is insidious or not. It's the ODA's position that, of course, it is. Certain crimes are so insidious: a forcible rape, a forcible sodomy, a forcible unlawful sexual penetration, that if a person is convicted of such a crime, there should not be relief from the duty to register. I know this is an important bill to all of you. I accept and I hear clearly, Vice Chair Krieger, your statements about the ODAA. If comment on that is requested, I will willingly give comment on that. But I thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Scott Healy, and I'm a Senior Deputy District Attorney in Clackamas County. I've testified in front of you a number of times already this term. Just a little bit about my history, though. I mean, currently, for the last 3 years, I've supervised the misdemeanor unit in Clackamas County. But before that, I was on our serious person crimes unit. And if I have a specialty, it's prosecuting child sex abuse crimes and also forcible sexual assault crimes. So I feel like I have somewhat of an expertise with regard to the issues that we're talking about here today. I echo, of course, everything that Mr. House said, and of course support the Dash 2 amendments. Not only does ODAA, but Clackamas County has been obviously very involved in this as well. I was also at all of the work group meetings. I found them very helpful. You know, as an old sex abuse prosecutor, I tell you, going to the meeting for the first time, kind of driving down here to Salem, you know, I wasn't sure about, you know, what the meeting was going to come all about or come to, but I had an open mind about it. We learned a lot of really good information, frankly, and while we didn't come to a complete agreement, I think that really, you know, what we have done is we've come very close, and we believe that the Dash 2s are the best law for you to pass. I just want to talk just a little bit about, kind of give you some context if I can. Vi Beatty, who I don't know that she's going to testify today, I know that she's here. There's approximately 20,000 sex offenders that are currently that have to register here in the state of Oregon. And so when we throw tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 at the committee, tier 3 right now, through the assessment process, the static 99 that you've heard about before, would be 6.2% of the 20,000. All right? And about, I think, 58% or so, and I mean, these numbers are, you know, not necessarily as accurate, would be tier 2, and then the remainder would be tier 3. So we're talking about, you know, do the math, 93.8% of all the people that are currently on the registry would be available to get off the registry at some point in time. Now, when we talk about 10 years from either the end of, you know, your probationary period, if you never went to prison, or 10 years from the period of time that you are off of post-prison supervision, remember that a number of these offenders are going to go to prison. And the current state of the law is on their post-prison supervision term is under ORS 144-103, it says that they are to serve a period of post-prison supervision, which is whatever the maximum period of time they could have served for the offense. So if it was a Class B felony, it would be 10 years. Obviously, a Class A felony, it would be 20 years, minus the term of imprisonment served. So frankly, for a number of these B felony offenders, they're going to be in prison for a long enough period of time that they're not going to be on post-prison supervision for very long. And so their 10 years is going to start to toll right away. And so they'll have an opportunity to get off, you know, relatively quickly. And a number of those offenders are very serious offenders, and I'm not going to go into, you know, the details of the cases that, of course, that I prosecuted. But I just sort of wanted there to be a little bit of context with regard to the numbers and exactly what we're talking about. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is the fact that we're asking that the first-degree crimes, you know, not be eligible for relief from registration. You know, rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree. I think what's lost here a little bit as I listen to people testify is that, you know, the assessment people there, and they were in the room the whole time, they were a great source of information. I asked them a lot of questions, but they will tell you, they'll say, look, you know, and they like to talk in terms of statistics, and that's fantastic, and it sounds like, you know, they're doing a pretty good job, but they won't even admit to you, you know, we're gonna swing and miss. We're gonna miss some serious offenders that are going to be allowed to get off registration, and they'll be victims in the future. Well, we're talking about, I mean, other than, honestly, other than murder, we're talking about the absolute worst, heinous offenders in our community. And it just, as I was listening to the testimony today, and sometimes in the meetings, what is lost is no one's talking about the victims. And, I mean, the severity of the damage that is done to even one victim of a child sex offender or a forcible rape victim, it's lifelong and it's never ending. It changes the course of their lives forever. A lot of times, you know, people end up, you know, drug addicts, and you know, they have significant emotional issues because of what happened to them when they were, you know, very young, or even 9, 10, 11 years old. you know, whether it be an incestuous relationship, sometimes that's even more damaging. Not necessarily forcible, but an incestuous relationship, multiple, you know, events that occurred to them. So I don't want that to be lost on this committee. And so when we're saying, yeah, you know what? If you commit a rape one, sodomy one, unlawful sex pen one, you know, those are mistakes that a person doesn't even make once in a lifetime. And if you do, you're going to have to register because we want to know where you are. Law enforcement wants to be able to track you. So that's where we're coming from with regard to that particular part of the amendment. And I know that the treatment people will say, well, shoot, you know, we'll evaluate them and they'll be low risk. Some of them might be tier one, tier two. All right, but if you swing and miss on that person, you know, they all their credit, it's up. They don't have any more credit in the bank. And so if you swing and miss, and there's only one more victim because of that person, because somebody didn't know where they were, then, you know, I think that we've done an injustice to the people of the state of Oregon. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I do support the Dash 2s, and I'm obviously open for any questions.
Representative Hicks. My reading of the original bill, the Dash 1s, the Dash 3s, are that they all include the 5-year period of relief for level 1. And my recollection of Vibede's testimony from some time back was that that's, I think, the lowest in the nation. And so if we pass any version of this bill besides the Dash 2s, we very seriously risk making Oregon a magnet for sex offenders from other states who are seeking to escape the registration requirements. That said, we did pass from this committee a bill that was designed to keep sex offenders accountable under the laws of the state in which they were convicted. And that hasn't passed the legislature yet. Hope it does. The law of the land, however, is such that I think we have no other choice. We cannot pass a bill that will make Oregon a magnet for sex offenders from other parts of the nation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then I would suggest we wait to take action on this until we see if that bill passes. I don't think...
Mr. Chair. We're not going to be moving this today.
I don't think there's any doubt that that bill will become law so that Oregon doesn't become a haven for people trying to avoid registration requirements in other states.
Sure.
But I'm fine with waiting to see if that happens.
Okay, we've got no option but yeah, either wait, I suppose, but today we cannot pass anything other than the Dash 2 amendments on this bill. That's my opinion.
We're not moving today, right?
We're not moving it today.
Do any of you have information about the number of sex crimes committed? We heard that 95% were by people who had not prior, didn't have a prior violation of the total new ones. In other words, the next 100 sex crimes that are going to be convicted will be by a new offender. Are you aware of that, or do you remember any testimony to that that we heard?
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, I have not heard that. I'm sure those statistics are available. I heard Vibede testified last week that of the 160 people that were relieved from registration last year, nearly 10% reoffended. And so I think that there needs to be some sort of reconciliation of those two statistics.
And Representative, if you recall, that number was given by a registered sex offender who was complaining to the guy who
I can't remember who said it.
The guy had been convicted for compelling prostitution of minors.
How did you forget that guy's testimony?
The guy with the Nazi picture. So thank you for your testimony, and I'm glad you mentioned about the victims. Once again, these crimes are not just some minor thing, and they're horrific, especially the children. We see that in the little girls. I mean, that end up, what is amazing is people who come out fairly normal. That anybody comes out fairly normal, and a lot of people do, but there's so many people that are so severely crippled by that. And, you know, I've read somewhere there's some evidence that some of the young men who have been sexually molested as kids cannot ever develop empathy. And it's somebody who has absolutely no empathy that can take a Bushmaster and walk into a theater or something like that. And so the victims are so severely damaged by these things. And I tend to be agreeing with you. I'm not willing to let people who have committed horrendous crimes because somebody thinks they might be okay in the future. It's a terrible price to pay. Sex registration is horrific, and I get that. But so is rape one, sodomy one, unlawful penetration, and the incestuous relationship. But we're not ready to move this today. We don't have paperwork that's necessary. Any further questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm wondering if people who buy sex from underage kids, are they on the sexual registry?
I don't know.
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, depending on the facts of the case, there probably is a sex crime that would apply and that they would have to register. If they're buying sex from an underage child, that would probably, you know, would include, depending on the age of the child, would include either a rape one or a rape two. There's promoting prostitution. It depends on the facts of the case, but all of those would be registerable offenses.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So how often does that happen? We know that there's a lot of child prostitution here in the metropolitan area. So how often does that prosecution happen?
The arrest, he's asking. Arrest and prosecution.
Yes.
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, I don't know that there are specific statistics that I can, you know, refer to, but some suggest that in the Portland metro area, which would be all three of our major counties and the largest, obviously, metropolitan area, that those crimes are at epidemic levels in that Portland metropolitan area.
The point I'm trying to make is that this is a crime against children, and it's seldom prosecuted. And it's as heinous as any of the other crimes that you've been prosecuting. And I would hope that in the future we would do a better job of finding those Johns and the pimps and prosecuting them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And one of the difficulties in those is that usually when they arrest the Johns, they're police decoys that arrest them. And so these other cases, they don't, you know, they pick up, they're gone to the motel or whatever. It's difficult if they can arrest. Once in a while they're on the street, you can catch them, but it's very difficult to catch people in the act where you can't prosecute on that. I've never found a reluctance on the district attorney's part, but they just get a case before. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Close
you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2549. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3467.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3467 prevents law enforcement agencies from publishing photographic records of arrested persons on the Internet. Requires any request for those photographic records to be made in person, be accompanied by a fee, be submitted in writing with specificity, and be requested individually.
Okay, and do we have amendments for this bill?
I believe there is an amendment, a dash two amendment for this bill. It just came in. I haven't had a chance to submit it yet.
So we don't have paperwork?
We don't have the paperwork on it today.
We will not be moving the bill today. Peter Overdorf, James Hansen, and Martha Duncan Perez. Go ahead in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Infuso. I am a criminal defense attorney. I guess this process got started with a letter and a little background on what the issue was and why it sort of came to my attention. In essence, in representing clients, I was presented particularly one client who had come to me, and we had had discussions about the presence, the person who's arrested, presence of the mugshot being on the internet. And at present, there are a number of websites that sort of pull these images, put them on their websites, and then charge a fee for removal. A particular client at issue that I prompted this bill and this discussion, and what happened to him was he had paid a $100 fee to remove his mugshot from one website, only to find that it had appeared on multiple other websites, and a sort of a cycle of fees ensued, making it difficult for him to clear his name. I think there's the present version of the bill is modeled after Washington County's model. Multnomah County, Washington County, this isn't something that's done uniform throughout the state of Oregon. In essence, some counties will automatically take an image associated with an arrest and publish that onto their local county or local law enforcement website. Others won't. What's telling, I guess, is that individuals arrested in Washington County where they don't publish that image of arrest aren't subject to this sort of online issue that is now arising based on the dissemination of that, sort of indiscriminate dissemination of that information. I think, what it amounts to when these images, it's a public record, clearly it's in the public interest to get this image out there. But the way that this image is then turned around and used, it amounts to nothing more than, nothing less than extortion. In essence, it's forcing people to pay to take this image off, an image that was very easily and freely gotten. I proposed the amendment, or the current version of it, to prevent the dissemination of these images on the internet, because I believe it's important to protect Oregonians from these predatory types of businesses, the predatory practice of an expensive practice of removing one's image of arrest associated with their arrest from the internet. Now, it interplays in a number of different ways. One, with the nature of the image when it's taken. It's taken upon arrest, and certainly not after conviction. So this image is out there. There's the presumption of innocence. A lot of these people will find that their image of arrest is out there, even though their charge was later no complaint by a prosecutor or dismissed, or they were acquitted. A number of different reasons why their image would not be on there. Two, people who are expunged, their images are still on there even afterward. But even for those. So it interplays with, the presumption of innocence, and then also it interplays with that expunction, the ability to expunge your arrest, the difficulties that arise once an image associated with arrest is on the internet in regards to the expunction statute becomes incredibly difficult because you can't really get that image off of the internet. It can't effectively be expunged. It would be expunged under 137.225. It would be a record associated with arrest that would be subject to expunction or setting aside the conviction under that statute. It becomes incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to do that without paying a fee to these websites to seal the record of that arrest. Now, there's an amendment which I think goes a long way to sort of provide a remedy, and it's supported, I understand it has great support. I read it just today on my way down. I talked a little bit about it yesterday. It goes a long way to sort of create an avenue or a remedy for people who have these images online, and either their charge was dismissed, they were acquitted, no complainted, or those who completed even a diversion-type program and had the charge later dismissed, or those who are setting aside their conviction to seal it. I think that's great. I think that people need that option. I think that that's a critical aspect. I think it's also probably worth considering the benefit of having these images online, because even if we do go ahead with the bill as amended, and it will provide that avenue for people to have a cause of action to get that image removed, we're still, what should be considered is that when local law enforcement agencies indiscriminately publish these images, they are fostering this business, and it's one that, in dealing with this, it's something that's across the nation. Different states are kind of taking different approaches on how to deal with this issue. It's only getting bigger and more expensive. The internet changes the game in a lot of ways. These images being on there, every arrest now becomes one that is, in essence, around forever. And I don't know if that's something that we want to do. So if local law enforcement agencies thoughtfully kind of looked at, what are the benefits of putting these images up there indiscriminately, knowing that the members of their community and people in their community are going to be subject to these sort of predatory extortion type fees Even if they were convicted, is that something that, you know, we want to say is right? So I think it's an important issue. I'm glad that it's getting some attention, and I support the bill, obviously. So.
With the new amendment.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I think the new amendment gives a great avenue for people to be able to do that. I think it could go. My preference would be that it would go a little bit farther and remove the images from the internet and make them subject to a specific in-person request. And the reason that that language was there in the original was just because, the way that these images are gathered by these businesses through an algorithm, they pull them all off of whatever website, tag the person's name to it, and then just wait for them to come knocking with a check. So.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Next, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Oberdorf, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3467. I'm general manager of the investment firm Darius Capital Company, which seeks to attract investors from all over the world for emerging growth client companies. My responsibilities include client and investor relations, administrative services, and brand reputation management. I also retain a website I've had for several years to periodically market and provide services such as brand strategy development, illustration, identity, naming, as well as writing and design services for web and print media. I rely upon the results of web searches to attract and gain the confidence of new business prospects. Darius Capital Company investors conduct a due diligence web search on Darius Management, of which I am included. A few months ago, I was pulled over for expired tags while driving my 85-year-old mother home from a beach outing. The officer asked me to perform a field test balancing on one leg, which I could not, and I'm assuming still cannot perform due to years of sports injuries to my knees and ankles. As a result, I failed the test, and I was brought back to the station and booked, which included having a mugshot taken of me. I took a breathalyzer test and blew a 0.01. As many of you know, 0.08 or above is the threshold for a DUI offense. After my negative breathalyzer, I was free to go. However, I had no one to pick me up, and they had already impounded my car, so I spent a horrific night in jail. I returned for a hearing on the 25th of February, where I was told that the judge had declined prosecution due to no evidence of wrongdoing. Regardless of the fact that I was cleared of all wrongdoing, my mugshot now appears in the middle of my illustrations and my business photo on Google searches. This is now affecting my career, my income, and the success of our growing international investment firm, a firm dedicated to finding money for real growing businesses. The first website responsible for this attack was mugshotworld.com. This website and others like them require me to pay hundreds of dollars to remove these photos. This is extortion, a violation of my privacy, and the unlawful use of my image. Since mugshotworld.com began trying to extort money from me, another mugshot of a woman with my name under it has appeared, this one posted by bustedmugshots.com. My mugshot remains plastered over the internet by companies which so far have not responded to my request to remove them. Again, this is very damaging to me personally, as well as my professional reputation and any communities, and it is also affecting the success of our growing international investment firm. Oregon laws need to keep up with our growing technological advances and protect Oregonians from these unscrupulous businesses. I urge this committee to support this very important piece of legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we've noted on several different issues how the technological world is just way ahead of us. Jason,
Chair Barker and committee,
little nervous. I've never done this kind of thing before. My name is Martha Duncan Perez, and I'm the chair of Washington County Reentry Council. In our work around working with people that have been justice involved, that kind of looks at a spectrum of people that have been touched into justice involvement, as well as people that are in and out those doors and locked up in places like jails and prisons. So over the last year, I've been the chair, and then coming into 2013, we decided to look at expungement reform and other issues in Oregon. After starting some energy around expungement reform and raising our voices, we found that there was a work group working on that, and so we went ahead and handed that over to that work group, and then we started to focus our work on background checks and those kind of things. And what we're finding is the more times we send out our newsletter and the more times that we have meetings and the more that we raise our voice around this issue, the more stories that we hear from people saying, you know, I've gotten out, I've done the right thing, I've done my time, I've healed, I've went back to my family, I've went back to my community, but where do I go from here? Because I'm still having to check a box, I'm still having to do all those things due to my conviction. And we have, what we're finding is it's difficult to find this person and tell them that there's a story about, you know, expungement being the next goal. What is the carrot that you hang in front of a person who's come out and done all the right things and become that responsible citizen and is now a community activist like myself? I do have convictions that still continue to be a glass ceiling for me, although I've gone a decade or more past those convictions. I find that when I'm talking to the next person and encouraging them, that my knowledge around the reform that's necessary in expungement and now the background reporting agencies that we're up against really causes me to not have a positive story to tell folks when I say, stay on the right track. It'll all come out really well in the end. So what we're finding is that story after story is coming forth and just bubbling up. I might go into a medical professional office, as I have recently, and meet the receptionist who then had this story after talking to me a few times and finding out what I do with my personal time, which is deal with people in reentry. She said, you know, this is my story. She was in a relationship where there was domestic violence, and she was not the perpetrator of that domestic violence, although that did come to justice involvement, and she did go through a similar situation in which she was processed through a jail or a similar type of facility, and so there was a mugshot taken of her, and she came away, and there were no convictions, there were no further charges. She was found guilty of the entire situation because the perpetrator was her partner. And so what she found was, if you, and this is what she said to me, if you Google my name, the first thing that comes up is my mugshot. I was never convicted of anything, but that picture is out there. And so she has had to change her vocation and go back to school. She found a doctor that was willing to work with her, and she now works in a doctor's office. But she credits the fact that there was a person out there that was open-minded enough to look past situations like her mugshot being the first thing that comes up when you Google her name. They saw what she had, the potential she had, and the abilities that she had, and what she could bring to that place of employment. That's not true in all cases. In a lot of cases, we're finding employers, and especially those employers out there that offer a family wage position with benefits and those things that you want so that you heal that family and that member that's been justice involved back into your community. You're finding that those are the employers that do those kind of background checks that take very seriously if you have a mugshot or anything that would point to those kind of situations. Our work right now is around trying to bring background check agencies into accountability so that they're not the ones out there extorting money from people and truly not making a difference in how they're presenting people and the challenges that they're causing in folks' lives. And so one of the things that we would support is this bill. I think the thing that really leapt out for me was that, you know, if there's any revenues to be gleaned from the release of a mugshot or such information, it really should go back into law enforcement, not into the hands of somebody who's just making a habit of an extortion type of a business, especially someone in a case that I've heard just on the way here, and I'd like to ask one of the speakers that have been involved in our council to come forward and share that. But you know, there's companies out there that you may pay that fee and then find out that's not the only fee you're going to pay. So it's really difficult when you tell a person, you know, you've done all the right things, you're off parole and probation, you're back with your family, you've got a great job. Now, just wait 3 more years and you'll get that conviction removed through expungement. Well, that's a big challenge we're finding out in Oregon. Or for multiple convictions, wait 10 years, just keep doing the right thing. Well, that's not really true here in Oregon. And we need to start recognizing that those people that make all those efforts to come back in and be a productive member of our community have all the support that they need. So if Joan could come forward.
Yeah, she could. You could go ahead and step back and we'll let Joan.
I just want to pop open a couple of images here that I took. And basically, they kind of outline some of the businesses that are popping up here. You know, there's whole industries that are dedicated to just removing mugshots and fees that you can pay. They're kind of small. But.
Well, and Mr. Chair, in front of committee members, there's also 2 printouts that my office provided of similar websites.
Oh, yeah, there's a handout there.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and the rest of the committee.
Be sure you state your name.
I'm sorry?
Be sure you state your name.
My name is Joan Ayala.
Thank you.
And my story is very similar to, just kind of piggybacks on that. I have a gal that I'm working with, and she was called me very upset, saying that she went for a job, and her employer had done a Google search on her name because she was highly skilled in many areas, and said, "Well, what? Please explain this to me." And there was a mugshot there where she was involved in a DUI several years ago in Park City, and. So she said, "Well, I think you want to take a look at this." So I went over and she said, they're saying that I can get rid of this for $300. And she said, so I had them send me the paperwork to do it. And along with the paperwork came another piece that says if there's other companies that have the same picture, if you'd like, we can help you get rid of them for $100 for each of the sites, and there were 4 more that they listed. And while she was looking at them, she realized that underneath each one, even though each company had a different name, they were all under the same parent company. So what was actually happening is the same company owned each website, but were presenting themselves as separate companies. So the potential was for, in that case, $700 to $800 to get rid of a website, a mugshot. And that's all I really wanted to say.
Thank you very much. That's good testimony.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
So, 2 more people, Patrick McCreary and Sean Killians. And I'll just state, put on the record, the representative for the Oregon Sheriff's Association says they oppose the bill, but support some of the amendments, and he had to leave for another hearing. He wasn't able to stay, and he wanted to especially thank Representative Williamson for reaching out, trying to get this thing straightened out. Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Patrick McCreary, and I am the current. I currently serve on the board of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and I'm the vice president and general manager of KPTV and KPDX in Portland, which are 2 television stations, and we produce news on both stations. I understand that it was not the sponsor's intention to prevent news media from using mugshots in our coverage, but I wanted to. The opportunity today to make sure that you understand that there's a significant benefit to the community when it comes to safety and security that we provide in receiving these mugshots from police agencies. We work very closely with every agency in the state, Southwest Washington and all of Oregon. And a lot of times it's a public safety issue when someone is at large and the community needs to identify this person. It's us putting up those pictures and other news media outlets using those mugshots. And easy access to those mugshots is critical when you're talking about a timely event. If I had to go down and personally pick up a mugshot and not retrieve it electronically, that would become burdensome in the coverage of news, and I think it would create a significant safety issue. And you can apply that to any number of stories that you can think of yourself. In addition to that, you know, it would become cost prohibitive for us. You know, we, as a news organization, we use anywhere from 30 to 50 mugshots in a month. And if you put that at $25 per, that becomes a significant cost. And I believe curtailing that and using fewer mugshots in our coverage would lead to some of the problems that I was explaining about safety and security, especially in a situation where, let's say it's a mugshot of a child predator and they're on the loose, or it's a case of a child predator and you don't know of the other victims. Well, those victims don't know he's been arrested and they don't come forward until they feel safe. And that's when they come forward, is when they've seen his mugshot and they know he's behind bars.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, so you retrieve and obtain photographs from Washington County Sheriff's Office, right?
We do.
It's my understanding their policy, they do not charge.
That is correct.
Okay, so that's all I need to know.
Thank you. Representative Robinson.
Mr. McCree, your opposition is the bill as written, correct?
Correct.
I've shared at least drafts of what I think are the Dash 2 amendments now with the Broadcast Association. We don't have those in front of us right now, but for the committee, the Dash 2 amendments, the original bill prohibits the sheriff from posting a website. The Dash 2 makes charging for removing your website or your mugshot from your website. It prohibits that. So it changes the burden from prohibiting the sheriff from releasing to prohibiting these kinds of websites for charging to remove your website. So it gets at the issue of allowing access to mugshots on the web for broadcasters, newspaper, and the like, but it doesn't allow the practice of charging for removing the majority of, or not the majority, but the a subsection of mugshots from websites.
Okay, I haven't seen it. It was my understanding that it would say, if you're not convicted, the
right.
things they've just spoken to, you can't charge for that, and
mm-hmm.
that if...
But you could charge for misdemeanors.
For a misdemeanor.
And,
Thank you. Mr. Jillians, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing Citizens Information Associates. Citizens Information Associates has a variety of different sites, which are commonly known as the Busted Grid, and they include crime maps, a most wanted website, a sex offender registry, a tip line for folks, and they do have a mugshot site as well. They have one single mugshot, not multiple mugshot sites. I appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Williamson on regulatory reform of this. My client does actually support the reform of this. A lot of the things that you've heard about today, they actually do take down site or pictures for free if the person was not convicted already. They feel like some of these other sites are actually hurting what their intent is, which is to get information out to the public about criminal activity. I just had an opportunity. I think the Dash 2s are on OLIS now, so I just pulled them up. I hadn't seen them before I came in here either, Mr. Chair. I knew kind of what we were working on, which is based off of legislation in Florida. I think there's probably a couple little tweaks on the Dash 2 that need to be made, but by and large, they look good, and they're something we could iron out in the next couple of hours, Mr. Chair. With that, as I see everyone leaning forward, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Are you going to stay for a couple hours?
We'll iron them out right now.
Is there any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate
you.
Your testimony. We're not ready to move the bill today, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3467.
This is very unprofessional.
That's pretty good.
We done?
Okay, we have just one more item of business. Colleagues, we're going to suspend the rules.
Are we still on record?
We are. Okay. We're going to suspend the rules.
Can we just stand down for a minute? We'll get a script.
Okay, we'll stand down for a few minutes.
We need to actually get a letter.
Judiciary Committee's back in session. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2115.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2115.
Representative Krieger moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2115. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? Not, the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2115 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2115 was referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, if there's no objections, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. The motion is once again before the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2115 as amended, move it to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2115 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objections? Motion carries. Representative Olson, will you carry that bill for us, please?
I absolutely will. I mean, initially that was from Representative Thompson, but I would imagine, yeah, he probably let me.
Good. We need co-carry.
I'm good.
We could co-carry it if you want. Okay, thank you. Olson, Thompson, adjourned.
Also, I mean, what do you think about me?
You two agree on something.